The Protect Your Neck Podcast, UFC 210 Breakdown Show.
Peace.
Vision, dreams of passion. And all the while I think of you. A very strange reaction. The more I see, the more I do. Baby,
what is up, my fellow degenerates and degenerites alike, or as I like to say, my friends, what's going on? This is the Protect Your Neck Podcast, and I am your host, Dan Tom, analyst and writer for FlowCombat.com. And today, or tonight, depending on what time you're listening to this, I suppose, we are going to be breaking down from top to bottom UFC 210 betting techniques, hopefully, at the end of which, protecting our neck, which, you know, we've been doing all right at. Not great, admittedly, but breaking even. So hopefully, thank you for using me as your reference point, and hopefully you continue to do so, because we are going to be sticking to the high-level techniques here when we're not doing the top five, as we did, because we had a UFC break, that's right. But again, that's kind of the beauty of, well, at least I hope is the beauty of this podcast, is that the alternate format, you know, can lend itself to when we have the quieter. Of course, there's, you know, ACB, Bellator, and all that. But, you know, as far as non-UFC, the quieter weekends was a great chance to catch up with my man, Daniel Levy. Shout out to Half the Battle. Him and Sean Carey Tattoo over there doing their thing. We did top five bad tattoos this last week with my buddy John Lee at John's Crazy Life. Thank you for coming on for that. So got good feedback from those episodes, at least from you guys. Seems like you like it. So hopefully you use the hashtag Protect Your Neck Podcast and submit your podcast top five themes that you would like to see covered on the show, you know, as well as your hot takes and other things you'd like to see me cover for the recaps. For these cards, which, yes, we're back to the breakdown show for this week with UFC 210. And I'm excited, man, top to bottom, there are, like, amazing fights. Gosh, knock on wood, I don't even want to compare it, but we have another amazing co-main event that, as great as the main event is, it almost outshines it, because the main event is a rematch like UFC 209, but the co-main event unfortunately didn't happen at UFC 209 with Khabib and Tony. But UFC 210 brings another, as far as high-level, competitive, important for the picture of the division, important for the fighter's career. Yes, that's right. Gegard Mousasi versus Chris Weidman. That's going to be definitely a fun one. And then maybe because it's Hipster Dan or whatever, but the fight that I'm looking forward to the most is an undercard fight, and we'll get to that in a second, but that's Charles Rosa versus Shane Burgos. So I'm really, really excited for that. So, let's jump into it before I keep rambling on. We're going to start from the bottom as per usual, and I'll number off the plays, the avoids, and so on and so forth as we go along. So the action kicks off on, wow, it's been a while since, knock on wood, the infamous weigh-in drama still, you know, can still happen, but we have a full deck. This is a full four clip, full four fight, four pack, if you will, on UFC Fight Pass, starting with Janelle Lauza from the Philippines versus Magomed Bibilatov. Probably mispronounced that, but this guy is awesome. This is crazy. It's like my two favorite styles, you know, compiled into one. I grew up watching boxing. I also have an affinity for boxing. It's a style that I personally love, and you know, would preach and would kind of be drawn to, especially as I got more in MMA, and Janelle Lauza gives you plenty to like if you just, you know, are a fan of boxing and watching that art of the sweet science. Whereas Magomed, you know, he came up, you know, learning through his uncle and kind of came up through a karate base, and you can obviously see that. And you know, as a karate guy myself, there are different styles. You know, I'm not as familiar with Kyokushin, which is more of a later developed, I believe, you know, more 19th, 20th century, later developed. George St. Pierre uses that. Shotokan, which just comes from a little more Machida. But I'm a Kempo karate guy. That's where my credentials are in, at least. And that's why I kind of can get a better read on guys like Stephen Thompson or, as well, Magomed Bibilatov, as far as just his kick selection. There's a certain – it's hard to really explain, even – even if I were to explain it to myself or a fellow, you know, Kempo karate black belt, but there's just a certain kicking rhythm that it really is instilled when you come up through a majority of Kempo karate systems, because I've personally met and worked with people that, you know, came from different lineages, different backgrounds, for better or worse. And there was a lot of the same tendencies that were in my game, and I see that with Bibilatov as far as spin kick. And of course, he does it way better than I could ever dream. But I'm just saying, as far as picking up, you know, a certain particular rhythm and his selections, and I really like it. It can get him in trouble here, though, because Janelle Lauza, I'm preaching on his boxing, but not only does he have a Muay Thai background, but he has a Wushu Sanda background. And people aren't familiar with Wushu Sanda. It's really popular. It's kind of the sport, like, you know, to put it in a brutal basic term, just kind of without giving the history lesson, essentially like a sport kung fu, wushu. You've heard wushu and wushu sanda. You know, it's gotten picking up, you know, not just through China, but, you know, there's certain parts of, you know, Dagestan, like Mahachakala. I probably mispronounced that. Forgive me, my Dagestani friends. But it's very popular and prominent areas of those, you know, Magomedov, for example, another Magomed, you know, he, uses that. But Janelle Lauza comes from that base, and you see it in the way he kind of catches kicks and counters. And I say Muay Thai because obviously catch kick counters are a huge part of Muay Thai as well. So I'm sure that lends itself. But the point is, Janelle Lauza can catch kicks and counter very well. So the obvious intangible, even though I believe he opened as a 4-1 favorite, Magomed did over Janelle. And now, by the way, at least I'm five dimes recording this, excuse me, late afternoon, more like early evening now, actually, on Wednesday. And at five dimes, he's 5-1, so minus 500 for Magomed. But yeah, the puncher's chance, so to speak, which I believe is a little more, you know, there's lots like about Janelle Lauza's game. Although the pick, you know, is Bibilatov, and he's actually a parlay piece of mine too, even at the high price. And I really wanted to get greedy with the props. You know me, I get a little greedy with my props, because I've had success in the past, although I think my misses have kind of leveled out that average. If you go to mixedmartialanalyst.com, I really got to do an updated average on that, even though that's really not my game. But hey, I hold myself accountable, hence I keep my record on there, so go check it out. But I usually get, if you know me, I get a little greedy, because it's a way to really test my analysis to see what I'm looking at, you know, not just picking a winner, making it a 50-50, but you can get greedy doing that. And Lauza, even though the discrepancy is on the ground, he's super athletic, and Bibilatov's like grappling style, you know, I mean, if you know, it's hard to say, because he's not exactly the process guy like a Damian Maya, who's purposely setting traps and kind of putting you in a spot. He's more of an opportunistic guy, like you see in the free low fight in WSOF. Was the first time why I saw Magomed fight. And he was kind of a little more opportunistic, because he's got just amazing hip tosses. And from an overhook, underhook, he just has a really great sense of that. And but you know, his aggressiveness and his floating kind of style allows his opponents to get up a lot. And that also comes from the Wushu Sanda, because I'm not sure exactly the rule set, but I kind of equate it to a judo, where judo, there's kind of a limited time they're allowed on the ground. So you see judo transitioners for, you know, their arm bars and stuff, etc. They're very fast about it. They're maybe a little sloppier, and they can get away with it because they've had to build their game to suit that specific rule set. And with Wushu Sanda, depending on what region you're competing in, there's a little bit of that too. So as good as they are as transitioning their strikes or turning your strikes against you to get you to the ground, there's not exactly a whole lot in that martial art to emphasize keeping you on the ground. So mix that with Janelle Lauza's youngness, his fight-to-fight improvements, his athleticism. I don't know a lot about where he's training, so that's a little hard to project, you know. But yeah, I'm spending a lot of this time on this fight, probably a lot more than I should. But again, I'm almost more sold on these early prelim fights than I am on these main card fights. I mean, there's just so much to like here as a hardcore. So again, I feel like, you know, if I'm being honest, Magomed's a little overpriced, even though I'm super high on him, and he's obviously my pick. He's a parlay piece, in fact, But yeah, he is a parlay piece. But that's more if you're doing, you know, you're going to have to be laying a lot to put him in a three man, or, you know, that's why I'm using him as a five, like going by that odds rule. I got to track the source of that. I'm going to ask Gigi, by the way, shout out Gorgeous George, MMA Junkie Radio. Gorgeous George is always a big fan, and I forget, I don't know if he got it from Joey Odessa or if this is kind of a unwritten rule, if you will, of the bookmakers, but doing parlays, you get a little bit of better odds doing them in three or five-man runs. And again, parlays in MMA is almost death. This is, by the way, this is a really bad card to do parlays on, so do it at your own risk. This is on mine, though, just saying. All right, we're going to move on to the next fight. This next one would be on a fight to avoid, because as far as outcomes or parlays, but I have the over in this pretty strongly, and that is Caitlin Chookagian versus Irene Aldana. And for some reason, maybe because Chookagian kind of let me down in the last spot, I was pretty high on her going in against Liz Carmouche, who didn't have one fight in like 20 months, which is a crazy stat. So I kind of thought Aldana was going to be favored, but I went back and watched, you know, obviously both their fights as I do, and was kind of reminded. I'm like, yeah, I get it. Chookagian should be slightly favored, and you know, you shouldn't get let an effect of a letdown spot or, you know, a fighter letting you down in a parlay affect your judgment. It's really, I say that because we all do it, right? Especially if you bet, it's kind of like this natural thing where you're like, oh my goodness, let me down before, I'm going to stay away from that person. But no, there is a lot to like about Chookagian's game. And Carmouche, very underrated. She showed why. She gave me the spoiler where her grappling, her underrated grappling and physical strength, natural physical strength, kind of parlays into that. But I don't think Irene Aldana presents that, obviously. But Aldana presents awesome boxing. I mean, the fact that she got dropped, that first round against Leslie Smith in her UFC debut and was able to come back within the round, regain herself, not lose confidence, be in the middle of flurries and kind of, roll out a punt, roll out against the fence and kind of have that in-cage awareness. I expect we're going to have a much better sophomore performance. This is not a women's fight where it's like, again, I feel like I'm being unfair because there'll be a lot of times on my avoid list, you'll see the female fights on there, but that's just because it's just such a small sample size. It can be a bit deceiving. And I think this is going to be a really exciting fight, actually. Like, I'm actually legitimately excited for this because it's going to be just a back and forth slugfest. Both girls are durable. They have high work rates. There's a lot about their technique that's a lot to like. It's really based on volume and rhythm style game, so it's going to be really interesting, that battle for said rhythm. That being said, because they're durable, I think the over is a really good price. I played it at, minus 245 it is currently right now, which is kind of high in generally speaking, but I was expecting it to be inflated, you know, higher, open maybe around 245 as it is now, but inflated higher even by now, which again is Wednesday night when this is being recorded, not to timestamp the episode. But yeah, excited for that one. We'll move on to the next one, which is also on the fights to avoid. That is Josh Emmett versus Dez Green. If you don't know a lot about Dez Green, Dez Green's been on the scene for a minute, had some success, got some semifinals fame there in Bellator. I don't know why I was going to say back in the day. Everything feels like back in the day now, though. And Dez Green's fought a lot of guys. Let me pull him up. I'm drawing a blank right now. It's been a long day. Sorry. How's your day been? Great, Dan. Stop having conversations with the audience and do your job. Okay, I'm doing it. Relax. Yeah, he's fought Steven Seiler, Miguel Torres. Remember that stop. He did well in Bellator MMA, 2014, beat Muel Martinez, Mike Richmond, Daniel Weichel, he lost to, but I have respect for that guy's game. Go plot a straight armbar by Rory McDonald, Rory McDonnell, not McDonald. Relax. I know what you're thinking. I did that on purpose. Just get you excited. What? But yeah, some guy named Rory McDonald. He even fought Rob Font for his first official career. He's been around for a minute. The problem is he's a bit sloppy when looking at the footage with transitions. He gets excited when he does hurt guys, because that's the thing about Desmond Green. You know, he's not just athletic, but the athleticism translates into power. It's just there's a bit of sloppiness to his game. And for a guy who has, as I said, been around for a minute, kind of worries me a bit. especially like Josh Emmett, who even though he's kind of had weird fights, I think the one takeaway you can take away is that he is a gamer. You know, the adversity he's faced in both fights, from his bone popping out of his skin against John Tuck, to, you know, the just weird performance where he was getting tired against a guy who can show up and not show up, but is deceptively tough in Scott Holtzman. Yeah, and who is another, you know, kind of athletic guy as far as, and I'm not saying it in a bad way, take away from their skills, but, you know, when you look at a guy like Scott Holtzman, who was a hockey player, didn't really have a martial arts background, you got to really attribute a lot of his athleticism to the fact that he's made it this far in what is a Shark Tank, the 155 division. And Des Green's kind of jumped all over the place, and I like his personality, but at the same time, in regards to his personality, you know, he was on MMA Junkie Radio, for example, recently. Shout out to those guys. I know I've been on there a lot recently, but so I'm obviously, you know, so there's a bit of a homer and bias there, but really should check it out. If anything, if you're just a hardcore listener to this for betting, it's good to hear, you know, fighter interviews and stuff like that. Other people do great fighter interviews. James Lynch, shout out to James Lynch from Flow Combat. There's a lot of great stuff there for Odds Breaker and other places. But yeah, Desmond Green was talking, and you know, he's the kind of guy who can make one. He's big, you know. I think 155 is just fine for him, but he can make 145 when you look at a majority of his fights, and he just doesn't like to because of diet, you know. He self-admittedly likes his McDonald's and his regular diet, and I'm not hating him. A guy who, you know, especially these days, is out of competition. I'm less judgmental when it comes to the fast food, you could say. So I'm not hating. I'm not, you know, putting my nose in the air. But when we're talking about betting fights or looking at every inch and, you know, things that may translate from personality to the fight game, because let's be honest, personality translates to fighting style. And when I hear those kind of things, it makes me, you know, edge toward, you know, the other guy in regards to stuff you can't see on paper, in regards to those intangible edges. So I went with Josh Emmett here, but with the line, it's kind of evened out. You know, there's some houses that had Desmond Green as 2-3-1 underdog in that case. You know, bet Green. Otherwise, the pick is Josh Emmett. That said, I don't have Josh Emmett in any parlay. I don't even think I played him straight up here. Hence, fights to avoid. Next fight is going to be the headliner of Fight Pass. Are we there? Yes, we are there. And we are to our only other piece for the parlay, I guess we should say, which is Gregor Gillespie over Andrew Holbrook. I'm a big fan of Holbrook. I had Holbrook over Sage Northcutt when that fight was originally booked, and I don't think I had him over Jake Matthews. I probably picked Jake Matthews officially, but I do remember putting strong caution out there in that pick, saying Holbrook is very live. He's one of those, again, you know me, if you've been listening to this, I have a weird affinity for like unorthodox grapplers, and that essentially is Holbrook. But what it comes down to is Holbrook, you know, is hittable, he's hurtable, will secede bad position, and Gregor Gillespie is, you know, I'm not as high on him as other people in sense of, you know, riding hype train and this and that. Like, I still haven't seen, I've seen it when I went and looked at his, you know, wrestling footage, of course, but I still haven't seen it in MMA as far as where he's getting comfortable, like where you see guys with that supreme lever awareness, like kind of Daniel Cormier when he was facing Dan Henderson, and just whether he was standing up to his feet with a foot sweep or taking out an arm post, or just, you know, of course, the awareness and takedown from the hips. You know, seeing Gillespie still kind of find himself as far as his transitions and where he wants to hit things, I still only expect him to get better. I expect him to have a much better improvement this time around, with it being a sophomore performance. Even though Keith Trimble and Belmore Kickboxing, they don't have, you know, necessarily the best defensive guys, I think Keith Trimble is a pretty good corner man when you listen to what he's saying. I think he's got the good people behind him. And I'm really confident in here. I think if he wins, the hype's going to follow him, and it's going to kind of inflate the line from here on out. So I'm maybe this is me just kind of cashing in while the line's at a manageable -240. I'm not sure what it opened. It opened a bit lower, but I don't believe too much lower. Yeah, I got Gregor Gillespie here. We're going to move on to the next fight. Excuse me. Take a sip of this, actually. What am I drinking tonight? Ooh. Sorry, there's a couple beers in the fridge. So I was trying to think what I grabbed. Oh, yeah, this was the Modern Times. not the pillow pale ale. This was the double IPA. It's got a little bit of, I don't know if it's pineapple, but it's not too fruity at all. It really just kind of lightens up, which I don't mind hops, but lightens it up a bit. But you know me, and I'm an IPA guy. It has that hoppy finish, so I'm all about it. It's got a nice 8.5 and doesn't taste like it at all. So that's always good. And what else is good is the Durkin, Patrick Cummins, who is facing Jan Blachowicz. Cummins, initially just a hard guy to bet on because you look at it and it's one of those guys where, like, it's hard. He's got that outlier sample size where he's an outlying athlete and he's a wrestler. So there's all these check marks and intangibles that he just does well on, from on paper to the off paper intangibles, right? Athleticism to wrestling. But these guys have a hard time getting fights. As you heard Pat Cummins say, it wasn't just his story. It's a many story guys of those profile. So they get rushed and fast tracked. And we saw that with Pat Cummins, and he could easily be one of those stories. And he's still be, you know, Jan Blachowicz hits hard, could easily wipe him out in the first round here. But you kind of saw Pat Cummins get fast tracked, and not just talking about the weird circumstances, which he needed to get into the UFC by fighting DC. But since then, he didn't have the easiest path. And he's taking a lot of damage. I mean, even in victories over guys like Rafael Cavalcante, who, you know, was pretty winless toward the tail end of his career, but was dangerous nonetheless, you know? And it could be one of those weird kind of poetic stories where you're like, oh man, was it too much too soon? And he just took too much damage. And then you add in the fact that you could argue maybe it was good for a style or not. I'm a big fan of Kings MMA, Rafael Cordero, by the way, but you look at a guy who's getting knocked out a lot, who's maybe a little too active. And then he's training in a high sparring, high intensity environment. Maybe not the best for your chin or health. And again, to each his own. I mean, I don't blame him. Rafael Cordero has turned many great, you know, grapplers into strikers, but those were jiu-jitsu guys who were southpaws, not wrestlers who were orthodox fighters. Not that that is the specific reasoning. I'm just kind of thinking out loud here, right? And but the interesting thing is, I'm a big fan of Kings. I'm a big fan of Ryan Parsons, who was kind of heading up Pat Cummins' career. But now Pat Cummins has been for the last year, because again, he hadn't fought since that little knock fight, took the appropriate time off, which is another plus here. And he went down to Black Zillions, was training with them. There was a split there, but stuck with my former catch wrestling coach, Neil Melanson. And Neil's great because Neil can do guard work and leg locks with the best of them, but really he's a catch wrestling guy and he's best suited for wrestlers. And you look at, I believe he makes everybody better, and there's proof in that. But when you look at the guys who Neil's work with who are wrestlers, i.e. Michael Chandler, one of the best examples of that, and Anthony Johnson, who we'll talk about later, you see immediate improvements as soon as Neil starts working with him. And that's just an undeniable fact. And again, his aforementioned guard and leg lock stuff only helped that equation, because when you're a wrestler on top, your biggest enemy is going to be guard and guys who go after your legs, because wrestlers are traditionally open to leg locks. It's not only a submission, it's an unorthodox submission that kind of favors to the rootedness of a base of wrestlers often putting heavy weight upon those limbs, okay? So that's where that kind of trope comes from. So just a great coach for a guy like Pat Cummins, all in all. Apparently they've clicked, they've been working together consistently. And that is exactly the kind of game plan you need against a guy like Jan Blachowicz, who, you know, is a brown belt, might have been a black belt in jiu-jitsu. And you look at his earlier footage in KSW, does some really great stuff, even off his back for a light heavyweight, which is hard to say, hard to do, and, you know, because it's hard to even give credit to, because it's a dangerous proposition playing off your back in MMA in general, much less when you're wielding the force of light heavyweights. But you know, Jan Blachowicz went through a lot of knee surgeries in KSW, pre his UFC signing, right, you know, before his Corey Anderson fight. And I don't think he's the same. When you look at his guard mechanics and stuff and the way he would kind of fight on the ground, I believe it was like a fight or two before he even hit the UFC, you kind of saw signs of this. And I don't think he can pull off the same type of moves. And again, being on your back, if it works on you in the regional scene, that's great. It's even if he was full, you know, foolproof, it's not a great thing to do, you know, at this level. And yes, he's working, you know, I believe he's working, I want to say he's working with Gustafsson and more All-Stars, which is kind of underrated wrestling for European team. Nevertheless, his tendencies on the ground is really bad. This is the perfect pipe for Pat Cummings to take him down. And I think after with the change of camp, working with the people he's working with, and just using common sense. I mean, looking at the way his last fights went, there's no way Pat Cummings doesn't wrestle here. you know, he's got to avoid the liver kick and those deadly hooks from Blachowicz. But plus 110, oh yeah, I play Pat Cummings straight up. And it's kind of hard to say. Pat Cummings, I could see him elbowing him to death and maybe opening him up a submission just from elbowing him to death and ground and pounding him. But I think it's a little more of a decision as I sprinkled a small flyer by decision. I left the inside the distance. Maybe it's a problem, maybe it's not. But I did put a whole nice unit, which is a lot for Dan Tom, on Pat Cummings at plus 110. All right. Before we take a break, because it's a full clip, so we're going to take a break before the main card, we are going to cap this first section off with, wow, my favorite fight that I told you. Shane Burgos versus Charles Boston Strong Rosa. That's right. Big fan of Charles Rosa. I thought he was going to be initially a little bit favored here. But he's been off for a while, and I'm a huge fan of Rosa because, again, he I don't know how much of a karate base he has, as opposed to I was kind of waxing poetic about Magomed earlier, but you can definitely see it in Charles Rosa, who is a chef. So I don't know. dude does a lot of different things, but he's got a really, really good ground game. You know, again, he sacrifices his position probably a little more than healthy, but me being kind of the weirdo I am and seeing certain things in unorthodox give and take styles, he's a give and take guy. He's kind of a presenter, not a Tony Ferguson level. Unfortunately for him, he's not at that craft yet. But he likes a lot of things, leg locks, little toe holds, and a little worries me a little bit though. You know, I'm worried he might be getting guys in the room with that. And as you see UFC high level, guys aren't gonna tap the pain moves for their paycheck. You know, you really gotta get on an armbar and start snapping some limbs or just putting him out with a blood choke, which he could do. So the problem is, you know, is Shane Burgos' takedown defense, is it gonna hold up? We've seen it hold up, but I don't think we've seen it at this level. I really like Charles Rose's chains, but maybe not his choices are the best. He's got really good single leg chains, but sometimes just the reactive doubles. If he did those more, the big question here is gonna be Charles Rose's fight-to-fight improvements. He's been out for about a year, and he's been traveling all over from the United States, different camps, to even, you know, training in Italy and Thailand, doing a lot of Muay Thai over there. So it's going to be really interesting to see what he does. But the problem was, the reason why I'm picking Burgos, and the reason why, you know, as you see now, Rose is not favored. In fact, he's an underdog, and Burgos is favored, is because I believe Burgos is essentially the stylistic antithesis. He's a pressure guy. He's got that attitude intangible and that durability to where he is not going to be dissuaded. You know, Charles Rosa has that chin and that dogged nature. That's why he's always in a fight. That's why this is on my fight. This is why it's on my fight to avoid. Is it? No, not technically. It didn't make my three, but it's up there. It's up there with my fights to avoid. That's for damn sure. And it's because, you know, Rosa depends on that, but he gets hit, and against a guy like Burgos, who's going to pressure, and kind of like a different style, but similar in theme to Jimmy Manoa, will pressure to get a reaction out of you, and make you do that uncomfortable reaction, and capitalize on it. Usually uses a left hook, like Mr. Manoa. And, you know, that's Burgos' money punch. And not only that, you know, I spoke about the kickboxing karate hybrid of Charles Rosa. Well, what's one of the best camps to face lighter weight kickboxing karate hybrids? Well, that's right, Tiger Shulman. You know, you've got a guy like Jimmy Rivera as your training partner, like Shane Burgos does. So there is a lot to like there. Really excited. And if you don't know Shane Burgos, he only fought once in the UFC. He's that UFC Albany card. He fought Thiago Trator. Not the best fighter, but definite gamer, definite big force at 145 as far as, you know, physical strength, maybe not force, trajectory, record, or potential or ceiling. But it was a great fight, and that was a fight where I think it was the first time I saw a guy get a haircut between rounds, which was awesome. Well, the retarded because of the, I'm sorry, I used the R word again, because that was a weird, just the newer commission, but just awesome in spirit because it was just crazy. I love chaos. I love dogged nature of fighters, and both these guys have it. I could probably, you know, speak for another, we're almost at the 30-minute mark. You speak for another 30 minutes about these guys. Or on these guys alone, I should say, but I'm going to save it. And instead, on that note, we're going to take a break, and we're going to save the last two fights of the prelim and the whole main card of UFC 210 for when we come back right here on the Protect Your Neck Podcast.
Cucarachas enojadas.
Right here on the Protect Your Neck Podcast for the UFC 210 breakdown. We were right in the middle of the FS1 prelims, and we're going to pick right up for Kamaru Usman versus Sean Strickland. This probably would have been my third recommended piece for your parlay, but not only did the line go up, my opinion went the opposite way of the line. I'm huge on Kamaru Usman. From what we've seen to even just what I've heard behind the scenes. Again, he was a guy who's worked with my former coach as well, and over at Black Zillions and CSMMA now is where Neil Melanson's at. But a lot of praise for this guy, Kamaru Usman. You go back and watch his wrestling footage. He was, you know, guy that would get takedowns from maybe non-traditional spots because it's smart, and not just technical, but he's a sharp guy. I mean, I've heard him do commentary before. One of Bilal Muhammad's fights over at Legacy, where he was commentating with John Morgan from Junkie. Shout out to John Morgan. But I'm really impressed with Kamaru's grasp of the game. But even that, he just has that raw athleticism. And you go back and watch his, you know, a collegiate D2 career, where he's able to kind of finish on guys from. Wow, that sounded bad. But the thing what scared me away from this one was just Sean Strickland, man. He's just a guy who, as far as his game goes, I have respect for. But he also has that competitor edge, man. And what kind of scared me away, and I guess I can say this because he said it on his podcast, Sam Alvey did. Sam Alvey, by the way, training partner, recent cornerman to Sean Strickland, since Sean Strickland made that move to Team Quest and working with those guys there, and also at Sam and Millennia MMA with Sam Alvey and Lorenz Larkin. But Sam Alvey, who's on the Pound for Pound podcast with my friend, my good bud Jordan Killian over there, listen to their podcast, was saying to, but Sam Alvey was saying on there, I won't tell you what Sam Alvey, by the way, said to the UFC betting sharks, which he gave great info there too, as well as just how good Strickland's looking. But a shout out to everybody in the UFC betting sharks, especially the y'all sharks who are listening to me and following me here. And sticking with me through my transitionary phases. I know y'all had some requests for as far as betting content. So definitely taking those into account. And hopefully this is meeting a lot of those. So shout out to y'all there. But I don't want to reveal what goes on behind closed doors. But what I will say is what is public. Because again, Sam Alvey said this on his own podcast, which you should listen to, the Pound for Pound podcast. That they're bringing in top-notch Olympic-caliber wrestlers and are having trouble holding Strickland down, which was kind of my knock on Strickland and reason for picking against him, because I do believe Strickland has an underrated ground game. It's not just him saying that about himself. There are things in his game that I see that I'm really impressed by. But he kind of had a propensity to kind of, you know, if you look at, you know, as near as the Alex Garcia fight, there was, you know, at least early on in that fight, a little too reluctant to maybe stand than he should have been. And then he fixed that and got the third round finish, of course. So he righted that. It's not a condemnable mistake, but something to account for. And apparently they just had their focus on that. You know, you account for his jab, the way he tempos it, and we'll switch off to a hook and kind of use that as his check and kind of use that to deceptively counter. This is going to be a fight, man. This is going to be a fight. So I maybe put Usman in one parlay for fun, but I really stayed away from him. This is a guy that I am still high on, you know, regardless what happens here, because Strickland's talented. But you tell the hiccups go up when I'm drinking beer while recording. That should be another note for longtime listeners here. But yeah, I stayed away from this one, although not an official avoid. Next fight, I almost want, this is the last one on my official avoid, just because of the sheer line. You know, this, Miles Jury versus Mike Della Torre. You know, I officially picked Jury, but I don't think he should be a 4-1 favorite here, or 5-1. And I think he may be opened as a 3-1, but I don't even think he should have opened as a 3-1. This is definitely his fight to win, for sure. But you got to look at the year off, the jump of camp, and now it looks like he's kind of back to San Diego, but also working with Rufka Gym, which is a good sign. So he's kind of following his buddy Jeremy Stevens there between Alliance and Rufka Gym. And with Rufka Gym, he's getting, you know, looks, you know, work with, you know, Jason Perillo and guys like that. So great for Miles Jury. Hopefully he returns to that kind of form, although was obviously a bit overrated. And I'd say that in a nice way, even though there's no nice way to say that. I'm not saying that in a mean-spirited way, put it that way. I'm just being honest. I believe it was a bit, you know, overrated on the skills and maybe not enough highlight on where the kid was actually good. And then you just kind of saw him maybe a little too much too fast. Because, you know, following that narrative, they threw him in a fight with Donald Cerrone. We knew what happened there. And you don't want to condemn a guy, but that really was a fight that looked like where a piece of a guy's confidence got taken away. And the fight with Charles Oliveira was very short, so it was so hard to tell. But yeah, he made the Power MMA change and got submitted right away. So, I mean, it makes me really nervous. And Mike De La Torre, I took him against Godofredo Pepe officially in his last fight. But unfortunately, De La Torre kind of showed the traditional tropes where he's tough and he's resilient, but he gets stunned all the time because of his aggression, his upright stature. He gets hit by right hands a lot, and that was kind of the beginning of the end, and that's how he fell into the submission game of Pepe. But I think De La Torre is very underrated. I think he could upset him here. I think because I stayed away from Jury completely, even though my official pick was Jury, I think I might have put like whatever the plus 630, whatever they're giving for inside the distance on De La Torre to catch him. Just for fun, I think I put like just literally like I put a $3 bet on that for fun. But no, the official pick here though is Jury, and that is specifically because De La Torre is hit by right hands. Not only that, Jury has a good right hand that he sets up from uppercuts to overhands, but more specifically, he will shift back into a check hook, into a southpaw stance that a lot of orthodox fighters are doing more, which I like, because a lot of orthodox fighters like would switch to southpaw to be flashy and cute, as I like to say. And they wouldn't do anything with it. And I would know this because I'm a southpaw and guys would do that all the time. And I'd be like, sweet, I always loved an excuse to practice a Muay Thai leg kick that I never get a look at as a southpaw. Thank you for giving it to me. And then do you land one of those and immediately people would switch back to orthodox. And then you kind of see the game progress and people got smart and they realized, oh, the liver kick is the best kick you can hit someone with. Because no matter what their chin is, the toughest guys can go down to a liver kick. It shuts you down. So that's why you hear even commentators like Mike Goldberg, who's not trying to kick a guy while he's down, but even he was astute on when a guy would switch to southpaw, he would go, look for the liver kick here, Joe, or body kick here, Joe, because that's what most guys go to. Now guys are getting a little smarter where it's still a little obvious why they're going to that, you know, southpaw stance, but they'll kind of shift and step back into a check hook, which I really appreciate. As that's one of my favorite strikes, a check hook, and especially a check right hook being a southpaw. I think it's going to serve Jury well against an aggressive De La Torre, and he should be able to win this, but again, I would avoid it for that price. And on that note, we are going to go to the main card. That is right. Will Brooks versus Charles Oliveira. I feel pretty good on Brooks here, although I'll be honest, I left him out of parlays because I feel like Oliveira is more alive than people may think. It's hard because essentially what it comes down to is, you know, Oliveira makes his money in the clinch and Will Brooks likes to fight in the clinch. And we saw against Will Brooks' last fight against another Oliveira who makes his money in the clinch, it hurt him. And people like to say, oh, it was because of his hurt rib. And no, he got hurt because he was fighting to not Charles Oliveira. I'm sorry. The other Oliveira. Now, there's way too many Oliveiras in this game. I'm the got three chicks pregnant on the same street Oliveira. I rode Rodeo Bills Oliveira. Rodeo Bulls Oliveira. What is his name? Oh my God. I am drawing a blank right now. This is Alex Oliveira. Wow, terrible. Terrible of me. Alex Oliveira. And it was Alex Oliveira's knees to the Will Brooks rib. So take nothing away. It was a clean loss, although it was really sad what Alex Oliveira did after. I don't condone that at all. But yeah, so that's kind of the danger here. But Will Brooks is showing fight to fight improvements in that area in his boxing. In fact, in all areas. And, you know, you look at his fight in Marcin Held, the way he dealt with leg locks and other things, who I believe Marcin Held is a better leg lock artist, although may not be a better overall submission artist. I believe Charles Oliveira is a better overall submission artist than Marcin Held. But as far as the leg locks, I was really impressed. Brooks is a really good top position player. He floats really well. He does a lot of shoulder pressure, things that I like. And just has a good sense of hips, floats north-south, just really airtight. And that's the exact kind of game you need for a guy like Charles Oliveira, who, again, even though I feel like he's live here, even though I feel that he's underrated, I also do, that being said, I also do subscribe to the stereotypical tropes of Charles Oliveira, that I don't like to use the word quitter. I think that's very rude, but also it's just... Although it could be true, you know, in certain instances with the Cub Swanson fight and other things like that. But there definitely is this weird, weird streak with Charles Oliveira that is not amongst many fighters, right? He has certain fights and weird things from the Cub Swanson to Max Holloway fight that guys don't even have one of those fights in their careers. And Charles Oliveira has a few. So that is kind of worrisome. He's been stunned or dropped or stopped in three of his last five fights, that's a little bit worrisome. You know, so ultimately, I feel like Brooks gets this, you know. And not to mention, what are Brooks' best strikes? They're not just body shots, which have traditionally troubled the upright shell defense of Oliveira that opens him up to said body shots, but they're intercepting body shots or intercepting knees or intercepting body kicks. And not only that, when he misses, you know, Will Brooks can miss a spin kick and immediately hit a sprawl. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, he's got a very good style in certain spots for this fight. And I think he's going to find a finish. I think he's going to find a finish late. I don't do very many 3-round flyers, but my fun flyer, my one and only fun flyer is Brooks, round three. Usually you can get plus 1,000 or above. Otherwise, it's not worth betting. But it's plus 1,150. So I put a quarter unit on that and then put a whole unit on Brooks ITD 172, played him straight up. I left out all my parlays because I do believe Oliveira is live enough to keep him out of my parlays. If he's live enough to prove me wrong on my pick and wrong on my bet, of course I'll take it like a man, no problem. Be the first to give him props. That being said, still not comfortable quite enough to hinge that fate and that belief upon the fate of 3 to 5 more fates, hence a parlay. So I left him out of the parlays, but yes, the pick is Brooks inside the distance. I think he gets it done late, so we're going to move on to the next fight, which is going to be Thiago Alves versus Patrick Cote. This is another admitted dog pick. I took Thiago Alves. I came in leaning toward Cote, and it's weird because it's like, I picked Cote against Donald Cerrone, and I picked Jim Miller against Thiago Alves. Like, crazy picks, right? Well, I was at least right on one of them. But the thing is here, I picked Jim Miller over Thiago Alves, not just because of a grappling advantage, which was a huge part of his victory, of course, but the reason why it wasn't just because of a grappling advantage, because Patrick Cote, you know, yes, he also has a grappling advantage. The French-Canadian is an underrated grappler. I believe he has a grappling and wrestling advantage over Thiago Alves. He'll be smart to use it here. But the problem was that Jim Miller had the stylistic antithesis, kind of so to speak. You know, like I said, Shane Burgos may or may not have against Charles Rosa. But I believe he has a stylistic antithesis of striking, you know. So Jim Miller, like, you know, up elbows, upward elbows, uppercuts, abusing inside angles of a cross. From the southpaw stance, a stance that Thiago Alves traditionally has not done well against. That's not Cote. Not only that, I believe that, in fact, this is kind of where the hat has changed, hence me picking Alves. I believe that Thiago Alves has the stylistic antithesis against Patrick Cote in the striking department. Specifically, knees are going to be the thing to watch out for. I mean, Cote has been hit with a handful of knees latter parts of his career, especially because whether he is, you know, evading punches, whether he is slipping, whether he is changing levels, whether he's fainting, whether he's loading up on his right hand, Cote drastically dips his level inside the pocket and it opens him up for these shots. And Thiago Alves is amongst top of welterweight or maybe in any division, as he has 5 KOs by way of the knees. And officially, that is on his record, okay? So I think that's going to be, you know, something to look for. But, you know, Thiago Alves, 1 fight in 23 months. He looked terrible against Jim Miller. And although the weight cut is absolutely Thiago Alves' responsibility, it was his fault. That said, I believe it was a bad weight cut. As Alves looked slower and looked sloppy. And I don't think it's a condemnable performance, because we've seen Thiago Alves come out. You know, 1 fight in 23 months is unsettling, but we've seen Thiago Alves return from lengthier layoffs against Seth Pazinski and look good. Jordan Mean, we saw him come back from adversity. And people like to act like, you know, Carlos Condit did whatever he wanted to him, but no, it was a competitive fight until Condit intercepted him with set up elbow that, you know, Jim Miller was able to hit him with, although not to devastating effect, but kind of proving my point as far as certain puzzle pieces lining up certain ways, stylistic antitheses, etc. You know, Thiago Alves has, you know, showed his speed, showed, you know, despite the Jim Miller fight, again, Jim Miller is criminally underrated and a bad weight cut. You get things like that. But Alves in other fights has showed improvements defensively and offensively, more so in his wrestling, even when it's hurt him, like in the Campman fight. But he's shown improvements there, you know, against Poppy Abedi, the judo player. You know, and yes, in more of his recent fights since the return of Pazinski, you know, more relevant stuff, his speed hasn't wandered. You look at, you know, mitts and footage, even though he's back up at 170, he didn't balloon back up. He almost looks like he's doing a similar prep for the Jim Miller fight as far as, you know, he's leaned down. I think that's a good thing. Again, I don't think either guy should be in your parlay. Although I'm seeing a lot of people put Patrick Cote in their parlay, and I'm surprised, because I was high on Cote again with his last fight, but not a lot of other people were. Now all of a sudden a bunch of people are. Maybe that's because the price, he's falling in that like -170 margin. So maybe that's a little sexy for people, you know, to jump on. But what jumps out at me is just his competitive streak. You know, Cote's impressive. He's almost, you know, tried to submit guys like Ben Saunders, but it's like he fought to that guy's strength for a second, and then he was able to finish him on the feet, obviously, and in the clinch. But the fact that he was fighting him in the clinch and on the floor and then trying to go submission for submission on him worries me, that he goes in these, you know, gunfights with Cerrone, and it's that competitive streak you hear that's often talked about. It's real. And now you kind of hear Cote talking about fight IQ, but at the same time he's saying, you know, in other interviews, I'm at my age, I'm not going to change. And I agree with the latter statement, because I think history, not just of Cote, but fighters in general, old habits die hard. That's not just a saying, right? And they're, you know, everything in MMA, for example, stereotypes are terrible in all walks of life, but especially in MMA, because everything is a case-by-case scenario. But we don't know outcomes, and outcomes are so crazy in this sport, so we do have to at least for a reference point, you shouldn't, you know, put all your weight or all your marbles or base your plays off this, but for a reference point, yes, statistics to a certain point are useful, odds, probabilities, all of these things to a certain point, yes, are very useful, and chances are, I feel like Cote is going to fall into this dogfight. Chances are, I think Thiago Alves is going to look better, kind of have dusted off the cobwebs of being back in the ring now, not having to cut the weight. And at the end of the day, Cote has been dropped, stunned, or stopped in 5 of his last 6 fights. And I don't like that trend. Alves, I do not think he's a quitter. I think there's a lot of bad things you can say about him, but I think that's a misconception about Alves, because you can look at these bad performances with a bad weight cut and all these intangibles going against him, like the Jim Miller fight, and he's still fighting. He's not giving up. Jordan Mean, who in hindsight, maybe not as impressive, maybe, you know, I hate again using that quitter kind of word, but I bring it up because people, whether they're talking about Alves or Oliveira, this is kind of words that come up a lot. I don't think it's just in some cases, where in some cases I do, but I don't think it's just in this case. And, you know, again, with the Condit fight, not only was he in that fight into that elbow hit, he fought his way back into that fight and was throwing hard shots at the end of the round, the first round, and then in the second. And when the doctor stopped it, you know, he wasn't throwing a fit and stomping like a 4-year-old, but you damn sure Thiago Alves still wanted to keep going. And we've seen that time and time again, dominated for multiple rounds, George St. Pierre, and we see him before the fifth round of the GSP fight at UFC 100, pacing back and forth. He's got a lot of miles on him, but he's only 33, and he hasn't shown that quit. And his puzzle pieces line up really nicely to Cote's as far as stylistically on the feet, where things line up. So I got Alves. I played him here. I played, that's one of the props actually inside the distance. I played it early, plus 350, because I had this one pod, I think, done by last week. And I only put a little bit on it, like I think like $5. And then I double dip now. It's up to five, plus 525 inside the distance if you like it. So that is one of the props. So yeah, okay, next fight is going to be Cynthia Calvillo versus Pearl Gonzalez. This is really interesting. Calvillo should be the favorite here. I don't think she should be a 2-1, which now she is nearing almost 3-1, which kept me away. You know, she's amateur accolades. She's showing crazy fight-to-fight improvements. Her stand-up's looking even more improved. I mean, she's you know, in her pad work, she's doing stuff like knees and elbows, and but not just being flashy. Like there's a certain smoothness to it that's kind of hard to pick up. And maybe now that she's training full-time and quit her job after her UFC debut, she's doing things that much more. But that said, I give Pearl Gonzalez a slight edge standing. You know, she has amateur boxing experience, more experience in general, both amateur and pro, which is kind of crazy. And this isn't a girl that was, you know, just brought in essentially, you know. The UFC actually had their eye on her for a minute, but there are injuries, there are matchup issues, if you look, which is why Pearl has only had one fight in 20 months, which is obviously a check mark against her, but kind of that reasoning. And not only was, I believe, the UFC unofficially looking at her before she was signed, I believe she was officially signed before this matchup was even officially made. So this is a girl who's talented. She has wins over Courtney Casey, some other girls in the regional scene you may see, be familiar on certain records. And so it's no mistake. She was a girl who I think was going to be in the UFC regardless. Too many intangibles kind of keep me away, but the fun fight in 20 months, the UFC debut. Even though I do believe she does have a little bit of a fundamental edge in the striking department. Really nice jab, really nice kind of footwork, sense of distance, just sense of the game. I just think she makes sometimes questionable moves on the ground, even though that's her strength. It's almost like it's one of those cases where she's so comfortable there, but it's like you're not Damian Maia level yet, you know? So maybe kind of tighten up a few things and not rely so much on your skill, because you see it kind of cost in certain exchanges. And Calvillo, not just the flashy stuff, is her back take that you saw when you kind of go back and watch her footage. She's a natural knack for wrestling against the cage, in the open, defending takedowns, hips, rolling through and rolling with things, lever awareness, and then the fact that, you know, it's only going to get better training with the wrestling heavy grapplers at Team Alpha Male. I think that's going to be the difference here. I think that's what's going to win her rounds. I'm not sure if this fight's going to be finished or not, because both girls are so talented, but they're also offensively and defensively. So I stayed away from the over. I stayed away probably from everything here, as this is, yes, yeah, it's the last fight of my fights to avoid. No shit, Dan, you stayed away from everything. But the pick is Calvillo, and it's by decision, because I'm leaning more toward that direction, although I'm not completely sold to that either. I just think both girls are talented, good. I think they're going to learn about themselves, and I think we are in turn going to learn a lot about them. So I would bet lightly on this one, and instead watch. Should be a fun scrap, whether you think it should be on the main card or not. Should be a fun one. All right, co-main event time, baby. This is a tough one. Probably a card full of stacked fights, competitive matchups. This one takes the cake, right up there with Rosa and Burgos, but on a much, much more higher level, a much, much more important level. I flip-flopped. I came in favoring Musasi heavily, and even though I ended up picking Musasi, I favor him less, because I actually picked Weidman at a certain point in my analysis, and perhaps this fight, you know, as I said in my breakdown write-up, which you can find at flowcombat.com, by the way. Go check it out there. If this fight were a bit different time, I would pick Weidman via wrestling pressure. But Musasi, in his defense, even though that's traditionally troubled him in the past, he's improved the wrestling areas, you know, in his game since that 2010 fight to King Mo on the Wall and Strikeforce. That being said, most of those improvements I feel are in the open. I still feel, you know, Musasi shows, you know, I still feel he shows improvements. You know, he's a little bit more high hoisting with his overhooks against the fence. But yeah, I believe against the fence, because pressure in general, you know, kind of throws Musasi out of his game. I don't know if it's a physicality issue or not, but he's certainly technical. But yeah, the wrestling, you know, the pressure game, and when you combine both those, improvements or not, that's definitely the best path against Musasi. We saw that against Jacare Souza. The problem was, Chris Weidman won't be having that same amenity of the small cage that Jacare Souza had. So it's going to be a little different. Which means with the square footage that Weidman's going to have to cover, that translates to, I believe, he's going to be more vulnerable in space. And that's where the problem is, because Musasi controls that space via his jab. He's very accurate with it, active, changes his tempo, feints, moves well with it, kind of compensates for his non-athletic footwork. And Weidman, to the same note, doesn't have the best athletic footwork despite being an athlete. When looking at his game, you know, is that left hook finish from, you know, and a decent left hook and an accurate left hand at that, right? But that left hook finish against Anderson Silva, but when you look at it, he mainly uses his left hands for paws and feelers, and he just wants to kind of use it as an initiator. Weidman wants to initiate an exchange to create that chaos because he's so good at reading. He's so athletic. He's so multiverse from his counter cross, even though he's not a counter fighter by any means. He has a good counter cross in the sense that he draws out these transitions and can counter his cross over the top or change his level, take guys down. He's got a good reactionary shot that compensates for a lot of the other areas of his wrestling. And, I just think he does that really well. But if he can't initiate that game, if he can't get his pressure, and Musasi does get a grasp on the exchanges early, I think it's going to be bad for Weidman. I think Weidman, you know, despite being stopped in the last two fights, I don't think his chin is condemnable. You know, those were legitimate stoppages, whether it's the one freak shot from Yoel Romero or the ridiculous beating that should have been stopped way earlier by Herb Dean. Which, by the way, I was doing some footage on that last fight, that female fight, and there's a fight, I can't remember if it's Pearl or, no, it's Cynthia, because it's them elbows, and boy, you just see Herb watching, you know, Cynthia on top, and she's just feeding this girl elbows for like 2 minutes, literally 2 minutes longer than it needs to be. The girl's cut open, bleeding. This is a very low level. These girls should be able to live and fight another. It has nothing to do with them being female. It's the fact that they're young fighters. And the young fighters, prospects or not, tough or not, female or not, male or not, they don't need to be taking beatings like that. Trust me, I can speak from experience. Bad experiences in the amateur or pro levels can really, really shape a fighter. And in fact, not shape a fighter, because you look at that poor girl's record, she didn't fight since then. And that's real common when you see a lot of these poor stoppages. It's one of my things when I see bad stoppages of a fighter real young in their career. Even if it's a no-name person, because I'm researching the other person, like as in this case, I was researching Cynthia Calvillo, I'll go look at that fighter they stopped. And it's really disheartening to see like a brutal loss young in an amateur's career. You saw like, oh wow, this person had like martial arts background, a whole amateur career, and they're three fights into their pro career, and they have they get a shit matchup because they have bad management, people around them, shitty promoter, all three, whatever. And then you compile that with a bad referee call in a fight that causes physical harm. Yeah, I hope these people are okay. Anyways, not to highlight or take a shot at Herb Dean, who is a really nice guy. I've actually had a drink with him outside of MMA, and seems like a really great dude. So I'm definitely not trying to pick on him, but more highlight that not just the best can make mistakes, but what those mistakes cost. You know, the unsung heroes or unsung non-heroes. It's poetic. and depressing as that can be. So, yeah, not ready to condemn Chris Weidman, his chin, back to that point, back to the fight here. But it's really tough. It's really tough to go against momentum here. And that's not the only reason why I picked Musasi. Again, I think Musasi, there's a lot to like about his game, about his scrambles, even his game from the bottom, his get-up game has improved, his wrestling. And just his striking and just kind of that mean streak we've seen just from not just his interviews, but his whole style in general. And he's had to prove a point. His contract's on the line. He's got money on the line. The UFC hasn't matched him up the best. They've given him really tough matchups, the ones that he's lost, and matchups that really aren't going to do a lot for him, whether he wins them or not. You know, I don't think they've done him very many favors matchup-wise, so Musasi has a lot of pent-up frustration. The only play I did on this one, which is a piece for my parlay, if you're at a house that'll let you parlay it, otherwise with the prop, this fight goes to decision either way. Minus 160 is the current line. I believe it opened at minus 155. So it really hasn't gone up too much, but I put this in parlays and I played it straight up. Again, there could be a finish here because both guys are so damn talented. And I would not be surprised to see Chris Weidman win. And judging by the closeness of the line, the fact that Chris Weidman was a dog and not for long, clearly I'm not alone in that thought. But the pick here is Musasi at the end of the day. So, yeah, that covers all the props. And there is only one more parlay piece, and that is the main event we will get to right now, and that is, yes, Daniel Cormier defending his belt against Anthony Rumble Johnson. Wow, I mean, I did a full write-up on this on flowcombat.com, and that will eventually, I do Art Tribe Network at mixedmartialanalyst.com, but this one's on Flow. The pay-per-view is done there, so please, again, check that out. But yeah, I go really in-depth in this matchup, but really, the dynamic is essentially the same. Cormier's pressure makes him hittable by nature. And Rumble Johnson has one-shot knockout power, so he almost got it done last time. You feel he can make the adjustments this time. I do not blame you for taking him. That essentially, in a nutshell, is the reason why people are. But if he doesn't, again, speaking to the dynamic, which I don't believe has changed, and I don't think anybody can straight face can really say so, is that if he doesn't get the finish, if Johnson does not, Cormier will slow cook him. Now, even though I picked Cormier inside the distance here, I will say that I was really close to picking Johnson. I'm not sold on either guy because it's that close of a fight. It's just hard to go against the grappling, more well-rounded slash, we've already seen the result not too long ago, side of the equation. That's three check marks I just mentioned, hence why I picked Cormier. But I do give Johnson more credit than most as far as his grappling advancements. And people picking Johnson, at least maybe through Twitter, I'm sure once I get to podcasts and although I try not to, but if I do, yes, I will wait till, of course, after my work's already done. But after I get this content and my breakdown, which already came out on Tuesday, toward the end of the week, that's kind of my candy, and I do like to see what, you know, other people's feels are, for sure. Again, I'm not pretending that I don't here. I don't think anybody's going to accuse me of anything. Y'all know I do the work. I think my work and body of work speaks for itself. I prove it on paper and off through this. But yeah, you know, I do like checking out other reference points, as I suggest you do the same. And you know me, I'm not greedy or anything with my shout-outs. I shout out other shows and analysts all the time, so no shame in that. So I'm really excited to see other takes, but as far as the Twitter takes, I should kind of clarify. I don't see a lot of people talking about Johnson's grappling improvements, and maybe there's a bias there. Again, gosh, if you're playing Neil Melanson and bingo, you just hit five in a row, because I probably brought him up about five times so far. But yeah, Anthony Johnson brought him in after their first fight, and you saw the improvements immediately. Granted, those were fights where he had Jimmy Manuel, where he should have been able to do all those things and then some. And Ryan Bader, who shot a terrible shot that was naked, and just, it's a tricky sample size there. Johnson did amazing things there, but it's hard to give it the proper value because of how Bader performed. Nothing against Johnson, not taking away anything from Johnson, about how Bader performed. But the point is, Johnson shows improvements there, you know, especially the two-on-one grip, which is a big, big thing that I preach. And the reason why I preach it is because, yes, my former coach Neil Melanson instilled in me to do that, whether it's from turtle or in close in the clinch. And we're going to be real curious to see if Anthony Johnson, instead of getting sporadic, panicking, and immediately just going into a defensive shell in clinch or grappling situations, if he's going to look for that two-on-one. Because we saw in the John Jones fight, John Jones just, again, I'm not a fan of this guy personally, but brilliant, fucking brilliant as a martial artist. One of the things I love most about John Jones' game is his clinch game, but more specifically, the way he uses that two-on-one, and we saw the effectiveness on that. You can't advance position, you can't strike, and you cannot choke somebody with one hand. Hence, even if you commit both your hands to one hand, all you have to do is worry about that other person's hand. So not only did John Jones two-on-one grip Daniel Cormier, he two-on-one gripped him on Daniel Cormier's right hand, which is his power hand, his dominant hand, the hand that he uses most, as we saw in the dirty boxing against Gustafsson. Completely threw off his game. Be interesting to see if Anthony Johnson does that. Regardless, Johnson has shown improvements on top, though I don't think Johnson, you know, even in his tired, frantic state, showed he could take Cormier down. I don't think he's going to employ that game plan for mathematics, odds of winning, and yes, the potential, even though I'm sure he doesn't like to think of himself that way, the potential of his gas tank probably doesn't bode well for Mr. Anthony Johnson in that regard. So, but getting up, though, I do believe Neil is going to be transferring his knowledge in that regard. So I think Anthony Johnson can contend. I think he can defend. I think he can stifle DC more than most people are giving him credit for. And I'm picking DC to win here. The problem is, and the reason why I'm picking DC to win, is because if the dynamic remains the same, even if Anthony Johnson can defend these things, that's ultimately, even with an improved cardio, and Johnson's looking slimmer for this, again, he kind of looks thicker for his 205 fights because, you know, he can put it on, it hasn't been an issue, but the two fights where he looks noticeably trim is his last fight with DC, and now, because, you know, we've seen on Fight Week, the weigh-ins haven't officially happened yet, but as far as the media, he looks really slim again. Regardless, there's still a tangible gas tank meter on Johnson, mentally and physically, I think we've seen, and that's fair to say. But yeah, I mean, I'm rooting for Johnson to do well. I feel like I'm a traitor for not picking him, but again, hopefully that is some credence to at least maybe not my skill as an analyst is, you know, I'm still just learning in this game. Although y'all are far too kind to me. But yeah, I do give myself credit in the fact that I can put bias aside, and yeah, I could put all that aside. And even though Anthony Johnson doing well, particularly in the grappling, would make me very happy as a preacher that Neil Melanson catch wrestling style and effectiveness. The pick here is Cormier. I don't blame you if you're with Johnson. Most people seem to be with Johnson. I think the one thing we can agree with, kind of parlaying this to my last parlay piece here, is that this fight is not going to go the distance. It got opened, I believe, like around 4-1. Now it's like 4.25, probably going to go higher. So again, unless you're laying down a lot of money on a 3-fight parlay and you're going to put it there, or a 5-piece, you could put it in those type of things, but that's about it. I'm definitely putting it in those. Excuse me, because that's like the only certainty in this whole dang fight, right? Is that yeah, it's not going to go the distance. So current odds, just to kind of close off on that, I believe DC is still the underdog and Anthony Johnson is still the favorite. People might have got excited like they did the Wyman line, although not as excited because, yep, Cormier went from plus 105 to plus 100, so people got excited on that. I played Cormier, and I played him inside the distance as well, by the way. But, yeah, those were just kind of small flyers for me. Nothing official, nothing big. Nothing I recommend you do, but I couldn't help it. I honestly pick him despite, you know, the bias of trainers or this or that. We'll see, though. I would not be surprised. It really does seem like it should be Anthony Johnson's time. But regardless if Anthony Johnson wins or not, I think people should give Cormier his due. He's definitely one of the best pound-for-pound fighters in the sport. Does not get enough credit. Okay, I'm going to wrap this up because Dantom's pretty hungry. It's been a crazy day, and the sun has now set as I look out my window, which means it's time to get some dinner in before it gets too late. Yeah. So we'll do an after party edition. Probably have my man BR14 back on the program because I think I'm heading over to his place again to watch these fights. I'll be on Twitter though, so follow me there at the MM Analyst. Make sure to follow the podcast at the PYN Podcast. Of course, all the podcasts are archived. I'm bad. This one didn't make it with the YouTube and the SoundCloud, but that's right on top of the list. I'm hopefully gonna have it by, knock on wood, next week. Yes, that's right. Next week I should have it by. There was a lot of developments, and this isn't me making excuses. I can't elaborate now, but there are some developments in the work that hopefully Dan Tom can tell you about here sooner than later. But yeah, there is a good excuse of why it hasn't happened yet. So if you're not an iTunes person, I'll be better about mentioning this, but MixedMartialAnalyst.com, all the breakdowns and podcasts are archived there. More importantly, the podcasts are archived there on smartphone-friendly players. In other words, you can play it on your smartphone, exit out, and still have the podcast playing, go amongst navigating amongst your different programs on your smartphone while still listening to it as if it were its own app. That's right, MixedMartialAnalyst.com. We will see you on Saturday night for the After Party Edition. And until then, my friends, that's right, protect your neck.